Good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to this plenary, mini plenary on addressing disparities in STD risk. Can residential segregation and other social determinants make real world contributions to STD prevention? I'm Delia Scholes. I'll be moderating this session. I'm an epidemiologist and senior investigator at Group Health Research Institute in Seattle. And Tom Gift, who just spoke to you, is our other moderator. He's the acting chief of the Health Services Research and Evaluation Branch in the STD Prevention Group at CDC. So this session arose out of not this being a new area of inquiry, but a very venerable one that's been looked into for a long time and acknowledged for its importance in STD disparities, but also acknowledged has been the difficulty in addressing it. So the Planning Committee thought it might be a useful time to check in on some of the practicalities of incorporating some of these population-level constructs into STD prevention and into the potential to address STD disparities. This session is set up to provide an overview of these constructs in the context of STD prevention, to provide a case example of some of the practical implementations of these constructs, and an overview of where STD prevention should go in the area of addressing disparities and incorporating or potentially incorporating these constructs. What we decided to do is to probably have all three of our speakers go in sequence and then hold questions and comments for the audience at the end. We really welcome audience participation on this. We know there's a lot of expertise and experience out there, both in the international and national venues, so we'd like to take advantage of that to have more discussion about how we might incorporate these in a more impactful way than we have. So I'd like to introduce our first speaker, Katie Biello. Katie's an epidemiologist with a PhD from Yale and an MPH from Boston University. She's currently a postdoctoral research fellow at Fenway Health and also at the Harvard School of Public Health in the Department of Epidemiology. Her work focuses on understanding and addressing determinants of social disparities in HIV and STI risk in high-risk populations, including racial and ethnic minorities, MSM, and male sex workers. Her work is both in the international and national contexts, and she'll provide an overview of social determinants and structural constructs in STD prevention.
Good morning. Thank you for that introduction. So as Delia so nicely introduced, my name is Katie Biello. I'm a postdoctoral fellow in epidemiology at the Fenway Institute and Harvard School of Public Health. Today, I think I have a pretty easy job here, which is to give a brief overview on social disparities and structural determinants in STD risk with a focus on the United States. I'm going to give a very brief overview of social disparities and STD risk. I think this audience is pretty familiar with the data, so I won't spend a lot of time here. And then I'll be giving some definitions of social and structural determinants and providing a framework for understanding disparities in STD risk. I'll follow up with a few examples of structural determinants of health and have a few concluding remarks. In the United States, disparities in STDs tend to impact historically socially marginalized groups. Specifically, blacks are disproportionately affected by most STDs, including HIV, compared to other racial ethnic groups. Men who have sex with men and transgender women are also disproportionately affected by most STDs and HIV. And moreover, black MSM and transgender women are at highest risk. Understanding causes for STD risk, and specifically disparities in STD risk, requires us to use a multi-level framework. And this depiction probably is not new to most of you. STD risk and social disparities and risk are impacted by many factors at multiple levels. So, of course, we have the individual level, which to me sort of things such as condom use, individual behaviors, condom use, characteristics such as mental health status. And these, of course, can impact risk. It is important to note, however, that studies have shown that that differences in sexual risk behaviors do not appear to explain racial disparities in STD risk in the United States. The findings have been pretty consistently showing that blacks are at similar or lower risk of risky sex and drug use compared to whites across different populations, heterosexuals, MSM, among adolescents and adults. Next is this interpersonal level, characterized by relationship patterns and sexual network characteristics. And these are certainly, particularly for STD risk, important. The data has shown that blacks who are themselves at low risk, so, for example, having one partner, are much more likely to have a high-risk partner than whites. So while your individual behavior may be low risk, you're at higher risk because of your partner. And lastly, there's the social or structural level. And these are defined by characteristics such as poverty, discrimination. And these are also important determinants of sexual risk and disparities in risk. These levels interact, and each are certainly important to consider, but the remainder of my time here will be devoted to the social and structural determinants of risk. So just so we're sort of on the same page, the WHO defines social determinants as a complex, integrated, and overlapping social structures and economic systems that are responsible for most health inequities. They're shaped by the distribution of money, power, and resources throughout communities, nations, and worlds. I find the CDC definition a little bit more practical or pragmatic in that social determinants of health are circumstances in which people are born, grow up, live, work, and age, as well as the systems put in place to deal with illness. These circumstances are in turn shaped by a wider set of forces, economic, social policies, and politics. The overlapping and key constructs in both of these definitions that I think are sort of key and important are the circumstances in which people live, in which impact health, and that these circumstances are shaped by social, economic, and political systems. By shaping and defining the macro environment, social and structural conditions influence health in important ways. They impact access to healthcare, education, information, they shape interactions, and they influence both risk-taking and care-seeking behaviors. As a result, the growing consensus is that social conditions are really driving the disparities in STD risk. There are many examples of social determinants, as I alluded to before, including environmental conditions, education, access to green space, and often these social conditions are intertwined. I'm going to discuss a few examples that all fall under the broader description of institutionalized discrimination. So, trusty Wikipedia definition of institutionalized discrimination is the discriminatory mistreatment of an individual or group of individuals by organizations, such as governments, financial institutions, public institutions, such as schools and hospitals. And this discrimination is typically codified into policies and laws of these institutions. By limiting the educational and social and economic opportunities, institutionalized discrimination produces stressful living environments. It decreases access to and quality health care for particular groups and reinforces interpersonal discrimination as well. And these outcomes can in turn directly impact factors that influence health. So the examples that I'm going to go into more detail about fall under, not surprisingly based on the social disparities, fall under institutionalized racism and institutionalized sexual and gender minority discrimination. In the United States, blacks are disproportionately incarcerated. Black men have the highest rates of incarceration. They're 6 times more likely to be incarcerated than white men. The lifetime likelihood of imprisonment for black men is 1 in 3. Also, in our studies at Fenway, we've found high rates of incarceration among black MSM and transgender women, as well as male sex workers. Many experts believe that this overrepresentation is not due to higher rates of crime perpetrated by black men, but a product of an unjust criminal justice system. And this is where it becomes institutionalized racism. There's also a higher prevalence of STDs and HIV in prisons than in the general population. It's estimated that HIV is 4 times higher in prison than in the general population. However, it's important to note, while some transmission is certainly occurring inside prisons, that a great majority of transmission occurs outside of prison. This isn't necessarily surprising, given the overlapping risk factors for incarceration and STD risk in the United States, including drug use, sex work, et cetera, mental health problems. Similarly, the economically and socially disadvantaged groups are typically overrepresented in prisons and jails, and there's the same groups that I discussed that are burdened by STDs and HIV. So various mechanisms have been proposed and studied to explain how mass incarceration increases STD and HIV rates in a community. First, mass incarceration of men of color is believed to disrupt sexual networks through the dissolution of primary relationships, in that partners partners of incarcerated individuals will often find other partners to fill emotional and potentially financial voids. None of this is very surprising. And then upon release, the formerly incarcerated individual will also find a new partner. And studies have shown that these partnerships are often higher risk and often multiple partners. Additionally, mass incarceration of black men results in an imbalance of men and women in the community, where blacks have the lowest male to female sex ratio in the United States. And this has been shown to be associated with rates of STDs in a community as well. And this low male to female sex ratio is in large part due to mass incarceration of black men. And this low male to female sex ratio can alter structure of sexual networks, marital patterns, interpersonal power in relationships, and family stability. And lastly, mass incarceration, the community reentry, and high rates of recidivism, where about three out of every four former prisoners are reincarcerated within 5 years of their release. This exerts a negative effect on neighborhood social cohesion, social capital, and organization. These outcomes then lead to an increase in sexual risk and sexual risk-taking among incarcerated individuals and their partners. Residential racial segregation is also a form of institutionalized racism that was legislated in the U.S. And supported and upheld by practices of economic, judicial, and social institutions. It's the extent to which two racial groups live separate from one another in a metropolitan area. It simultaneously describes the racial composition of neighborhoods and the distribution of these neighborhoods within a larger metropolitan area. Sociologists define segregation using 5 distinct dimensions. There's isolation, concentration, clustering, centralization, and unevenness. Rather than go into each of these dimensions now, I did want to pick one to sort of give you a better understanding of what segregation in the United States really is. So using the unevenness areas are uneven if minorities are overrepresented in some neighborhoods and underrepresented in other neighborhoods compared to the metro area as a whole. So this depiction, the top section here that's circled, is an area defined by high segregation, a metropolitan area. These small yellow-ish squares depict neighborhoods. The green represents, in this sort of in our example, whites living in these neighborhoods, and the red represents blacks living in these neighborhoods. In this area with high segregation, you can see that there's neighborhoods that are highly white and neighborhoods that are highly black in racial composition. Conversely, this area, but defined by low segregation, the black and white population are more evenly distributed. So that's sort of one extreme and simple depiction of segregation. So blacks are more segregated than any other racial group in the United States. It's estimated that two-thirds of blacks live in highly segregated areas. And they're more segregated across all income levels, regardless of income. Segregation creates very different environments and contexts for blacks and whites. Therefore, it's not surprising that studies have shown that living in more segregated areas is associated with multiple poor health outcomes, including tuberculosis, low birth weight, all-cause mortality, smoking, and the list is growing. Many experts have postulated that segregation is a possible cause of disparities in STD risk. We recently reviewed the evidence, and there have been generally consistent findings that segregation may help explain the racial disparities in STDs in the United States. And interestingly, to add to this evidence, a recent meta-analysis that came out in Social Science and Medicine this year showed the effectiveness of individual-level, single-session interventions to increase condom use differed by level of segregation of the target community. So specifically, condom interventions were not successful in areas defined by high segregation. This is an effect size of zero, whereas they were successful in areas with low segregation, the moderate effect size of 0.68, suggesting that there are more individual levels, that more than individual level sessions need to be done to close this disparity gap. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here because I think my time is running low, but it's hypothesized that segregation impacts sexual risk in a couple of ways. First, directly by impacting sexual networks. Differences in networks, including density, may uncover important risk or protective factors for disease risk and disparities in disease risk. And we're starting to begin to study this potential role of differences in sexual networks to explain differences in risk for men who have sex with men and male sex workers in the Boston area. Additionally, segregation may impact behaviors indirectly by concentrating economic, social, and political disadvantage and reducing access to resources. These characteristics can then impact individual risk behaviors and have been shown to be associated with STD risk. Institutionalized sexual and gender minority discrimination remains pervasive in the United States, even with an improved socio-political climate. Slip of the tongue. As of today, a majority of states have constitutional amendments banning same-sex marriage. More than a third of states do not include sexual orientation or gender identity in hate crime laws. And many states, including my own, Massachusetts, still don't include protections for gender minorities within public accommodation sections of non-discrimination laws, thus permitting overt discrimination in public and private places where individuals go for services and goods. So sexual and gender minority discrimination impacts STD risk by impeding the establishment and maintenance of intimate relationships. It discourages disclosure, reduces access to quality health care, increases stress, social isolation, internalized stigma, and other poor mental health outcomes. All of these, in turn, can lead to riskier partnerships, fewer protective behaviors like regular testing, as well as riskier substance use and sexual behaviors. And it's important to note that the impact of discrimination is compounded for black MSM and transgender women. So, to conclude, very briefly, because I'm out of time, and actually, this is good because my co-speakers will be touching upon all of these points in more detail. I think some of the obstacles that we've had to addressing social determinants is that they're difficult. They're difficult to measure, and as an epidemiologist, I like to have sort of to be able to see clear causal pathways and to be able to measure sort of an exposure and its direct effect on an outcome. And it's difficult to do with these things that are so intertwined at so many levels. I think we've had a lack of training and also a lack of funding in this area as well. However, I'd argue that given the current state that we can and should make progress in this area. And some of the things we can do is to use natural experiments where we take advantage of changes that are actually happening currently in policies such as housing policies and marriage laws and healthcare coverage and study the impact on these outcomes. And Dr. Cooper will be speaking about one of these examples in just a minute. And then also, oops, I'm sorry, go back. Also, I think we should continue consider structural level interventions, such as criminal justice reform, public education reform, job training programs. The lists can really go on. These can have very broad benefits. And then finally, I won't get into this much because I know this will be talked about a lot, but we should be collaborating across sectors and across sort of outcomes of interest where there's a common cause. So thank you. And I'm sorry I ran over a few minutes.